For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we've been working our way through the Ten Commandments. We've got six down, and tonight we're going to knock out the final four. Remember these commandments. The year is around 1450 BC. The location is the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula, desert at Mount Sinai. And these were spoken directly to the Israelites in the midst of the thunder and the lightning and the cloud of smoke, directly to the people as they stood at the base of the mountain, God directly addressing them. And he reminds them that he is Yahweh. He is the God who's rescued them. And that is the basis for any sort of right and wrong we saw 2 weeks ago. And we also saw that these are given after he had already rescued them from Egypt. So it's in the context of a relationship. They've already received his salvation. And now he's asking them to respond in this way. God is trying to teach his people how to live. You know, this is the good life, both in the sense that it's ethically right and this is the best way to live. He's trying to help us to avoid, last week I gave the example of like a lighthouse on a dark and stormy night. You know, these laws are posted here so God can help us to avoid the shipwreck that will certainly follow if we just live life kind of feeling our way through and trying to figure it out on our own. God is revealing to us what is right and what is wrong, how to live and how not to live. These commandments we've also talked about, each of the last 2 weeks, we've talked about how these center around the first four commandments talk about our need to love God. And then the next six commandments talk about our need to love one another. And we read Matthew 22. You know, this is how Jesus summarized the entire Old Testament law, is to love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love one another. And, you know, even to love one another in this way that God defines love, you know, this is an act of respect and honor for the God who's showing us how to live. You know, love is kind of a vague general term. You know, we can say the important part is to love God and love one another, but there's still a lot of wiggle room within that umbrella. Different people might define love in different ways. And so part of what God is doing is he's spelling out, here are the details. Here's what it means to love God and to love one another. You know, we might say to God, God, I love you so much, and I worship all these other gods too. And God would be like, that's not the kind of relationship we have. You have no other gods before me. And we'll be like, you know, God, I just love this woman so much that I had sex with her, and then I killed her husband so we could be together because our love is so strong, and then I robbed a jewelry store so she could have something nice to wear. And God's like, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not kill. And so, you know, God is showing us what his definition of love is. And so that's what we're going to see tonight. We want to think about, part of the problem is we tend to think we're pretty good people. And so one thing that God's moral law is really good for is showing us that we've set the bar way too low. And so we want to try to put this back up where it belongs, which is how God intended it to be given. And we'll talk a little bit about how each of these relates to the idea of loving one another. And on the other hand, how failure to follow these laws would be selfishness, unloving. So Exodus 20, the seventh commandment, you must not commit adultery. You must not commit adultery. So this one pertains to both the marriage relationship and our sex lives. So this one, you know, sex is obviously a topic that a lot of us are pretty interested in. And, you know, the reason for that is because of how God has designed us and because of how God designed sex. God's design for sex, I wish we could spend the whole night on this. I really do. We could spend several weeks talking about this, and we have before. So I'm going to have to be brief here. God designed sex for unity, pleasure, and reproduction. You know, when Jesus taught on sex, he goes back to when it was first instituted in Genesis 2, and he talks about how he says a man will leave his father and mother, and he'll become joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And so it's an act of becoming one with your spouse. Of course, there's elements of reproduction involved in sex as well. You know, this is how babies are made. I'm not going to go into that either. But also there's a significant pleasure component here as well, and that's something God intended. I mean, you know, it's possible, you know, a lot of different, creatures that God made, they reproduce without pleasure, okay?
But for humans, for some reason, he made it this intensely pleasurable experience. You know, he's the one that designed those parts to function that way, to feel that way. You know, God's not up there looking down and be like, what are they doing with that thing there? And so there's a certain design to this whole thing. And what God says is that marriage, biblical marriage, is the only safe environment for sex, and that would be monogamous, heterosexual, lifelong commitment, according to the clear teaching of the scriptures on this, including Jesus. That is the only safe environment, because this is such a powerful bond. This is not something that should just be given out here, there, or whenever. And when we do that, when we ignore God's teaching on this, it's going to bring many harmful consequences into our lives. Remember that analogy again of the lighthouse. You know, this is a major rock that we can destroy ourselves on. Let's think about some of these consequences. For one, there's the disease that, you know, is pretty well known and talked about. You know, this is just about the only danger of sex if you talk to a lot of people. And so, you know, that's why you use contraception and things like that. People don't often talk about the misery and the loneliness that comes from misusing sex. Many of us have probably experienced this firsthand. You think about this study from the Journal of Development and Behavioral Pediatrics. It says tests reveal that adolescents who are sexually active had significantly higher depression scores than non-sexually active subjects. Depression was positively correlated with the number of partners in the previous 3 months. So as promiscuity went up, depression went up. And having a strong sense of purpose in life was significantly negatively correlated with the number of sexual partners in the previous 3 months. And so the more of a sense of purpose you had in your life, the more content and I think fulfillment is kind of tied in here, the less likely you were to have had a lot of sexual partners. There's the inability to form families later. You know, we think we can, you know, I'm young now, I can enjoy this, I can sleep around, and then I'll just flip it off at some point when I have a family someday, when I get married. Because, you know, in spite of our attitudes on sex, most people in this generation would say that one of their greatest desires in life is to have a successful marriage and a successful family. Well, the inability to form families later, you know, one quote from the monogamy myth. Peggy Vaughn says conservative estimates are that 60% of men and 40% of women will have an affair. That's maybe shocking, but, you know, it fits with a promiscuous culture that thinks that once I get married, then I can just turn that off. That's not the case. You kind of get addicted to immoral sex. You know, sex, what's exciting about sex, and the reason why in good, healthy marriages, sex actually should get better every year. And the reason for that is because the deepening trust that you have with one another, because of the closeness that you have with one another. And, you know, in the world's view of sex, what's exciting is youth and beauty and variety. And that's completely opposite to the biblical picture of sex. This is some quotes from a kind of a lengthy paper. Dr. Jill Manning out of BYU, she actually had to stand before the U.S. Senate a few years back to report on the effects of pornography. And the question was, you know, what should the government do about pornography? And does the government need to do anything about it? And, you know, she went through, you know, tons of different papers, peer-reviewed articles, and, you know, put this paper together. And it's really fascinating read, talking about the negative effects of pornography on the family. And I've just picked a few quotes from her cover letter here that went on the front of the whole paper. And here's what she says. The research indicates pornography consumption is associated with the following six trends, among others. One, increased marital distress and risk of separation and divorce. Two, decreased marital intimacy and sexual satisfaction. And so the more we get into this porno, the less happy we are with our marriage and with our marital sex life. Infidelity is obviously going to be directly tied to getting into pornography. Increased appetite for more graphic types of pornography. You know, the thing that was exciting before isn't as exciting anymore. And so you end up getting into, you know, more explicit stuff. Devaluation of monogamy, marriage, and child rearing. The more into porno people are, the more they just drink in the world's view on sex, the less they place a value on monogamy, marriage, and raising kids. an increasing number of people struggling with compulsive and addictive sexual behavior. You know, because it's not satisfying, you know, it is satisfying, but only for, you know, a very brief moment. And then you've got to have even more just to get to that same level of stimulation. That's, you know, a recipe for addiction, where you need more and more and more and more, and it's never enough, never enough, never enough. That's the way this works. These trends reflect a cluster of symptoms that undermine the foundation upon which successful marriages and families are established. And she says, while the marital bond may be the most vulnerable relationship to internet porn, children and adolescents are the most vulnerable audience. It doesn't just affect mom and dad, but it also affects the kids. She says, when a child lives in a home where an adult is consuming porno, he or she encounters the following four risks. One, decreased parental time and attention. More time is being spent on me. You know, it's basically an inherently selfish lifestyle. And also increased risk of encountering pornographic material. You know, a lot of us, probably the first time we came across porno was it was maybe one of our parents that we stumbled across. Increased risk of parental separation and divorce. And, you know, the risks of the impact of divorce on kids is well documented, super negative. And increased risk of parental job loss and financial strain. But, you know, when they are exposed to it in a household like that, there's even more negative effects. You know, lasting negative or traumatic emotional responses can really mess kids up. And they may not even sense, they may not even realize how bad it is until later in life. Early onset of first sexual intercourse, thereby increasing the risk of STDs. The belief that superior sexual satisfaction is attainable without having affection for one's partner, thereby reinforcing the commoditization of sex and the objectification of humans. Commoditization means it's a commodity that you can buy and trade and sell. And so, you know, it's like going down to the store and picking up a gallon of milk or something like that. You know, sex is basically, it's something you order and you pay for and it's delivered to you. Humans, they're not people, they're objects. Affection, what role does affection play in this? None at all. Not in the pornos and not when they're into porno. The belief that being married or having a family are unattractive prospects. It makes family and monogamous marriage much more unappealing. Increased risk for developing sexual compulsions and addictive behavior. Increased risk of exposure to incorrect information about sex at an age when they can't absorb and process that. And finally, overestimating the prevalence of less common practices like group sex, bestiality, sadomasochistic activity. You know, sex is just like this really exotic thing that you see in the pornos. And, you know, when we don't use sex in God's way, you're really harming your ability to be a good parent someday, to have a good family, and to have a good marriage. There's the damage that's done to children, like we just talked about. There's the distrust and the shame that comes along with it. Deep down, we know that something very profound and very wrong just happened here. And, you know, you may have built up calluses by now, but, you know, when people are like, no, it doesn't affect me that deeply, this is not becoming one with the person, I would challenge you to think back to your first experience and think about how you felt right after that. Think about the sense of shame. Think about the sense of distrust. If, I mean, assuming your first experience was, you know, not within marriage. You know, another one related to this would be the effects of cohabitation. Again, which we could talk for a while about. But, you know, cohabitation, under the world's view of sex, it actually makes a lot of sense to live with the person for a while, to sleep with each other for a while, before you commit yourself to the other person long term. And, you know, if sex is just about, you know, sexual compatibility and how good the other person is in bed, then, you know, that would make a lot of sense. But if sex is about trust, then we would expect living together outside of wedlock would actually have a negative impact on your relationship. Well, here this extensive study from about 10 years ago talks about cohabitation, and it says, virtually all research on the topic has determined that the chances of divorce ending a marriage preceded by cohabitation are significantly greater than for a marriage not preceded by cohabitation. The risk of that marriage failing actually goes up quite a bit, even if it even makes it to marriage, which a lot of them don't. living together before marriage increases the risk of breaking up after you get married. It says that unmarried couples have lower levels of happiness and well-being than married couples. And it says no positive contribution of cohabitation to marriage has ever been found. Well, how does that fit? How does that flow from the world's view on sex, which is it's something selfish for me to take? You know, don't you think that, cohabitation would make more sense? That would make us more likely to succeed? The answer is no. And the reason why, it says, while marriages are held together largely by a strong ethic of commitment, cohabiting relationships, by their very nature, tend to undercut this ethic. Our results indicate that cohabitation continued to be a risk factor for troubled marriages in the year 2000, despite the fact that more than 40% of all couples had lived together before marriage. But that continues to be a risk factor, even as the number of cohabiting couples increases. This pattern of findings is consistent with the belief that something about the experience of cohabitation lowers subsequent marital quality. I remember talking to a woman I used to work with back before I worked for the church, and she was telling me about how she had lived with her her partner for many years, and they had finally broken up. And I kind of tentatively was like, I've actually read places that cohabiting can actually hurt your chances of having a successful relationship. And before I could even finish the sentence, she was like, oh, I totally agree. That was exactly my experience. You know, when you realize that that person could be out the back door at any time, you know, you're about 3 minutes away from maybe never seeing this person again. And there's nothing that you can do about it. Knowing this person won't commit to me. And so you basically know you're using each other. That's the problem with selfish sex. With sex according to the world, sex outside of a marriage commitment is you're using each other. And both people know it. There's the anger, bitterness, and jealousy. I remember talking to a friend of mine who got sexually involved with his girlfriend, and he was like, you know, when we did that, things got pretty weird in this relationship. You know, all of a sudden there was kind of almost a crazy jealousy. And he felt like she changed when they started sleeping together. An irrational fear that this person is going to leave me. Quick to get angry, quick to get bitter, kind of a closing off in some ways. And the reason, that's exactly what you would expect if you become one flesh and yet you guys won't commit to each other. You know, and I remember at the time he was like, well, you know, we're definitely going to get married, so I think it's okay. And I was like, why don't you just get married? And he's like, well, you know, we're not ready for marriage yet. And, you know, when people say that, it's like, marriage, it's actually not that hard to go and do. You know, $40, go down to the courthouse, get a piece of paper. I mean, if marriage is just a piece of paper, why don't you just go ahead and get it if it's not that big of a deal? And the answer is, well, to be honest, I'm not totally sure. And, you see some problems in the relationship, and, you know, the person doesn't always make me feel good all the time, and you see other guys or other girls out there, and you're just not ready to get tied down and be in a position where you can't just take. Finally, in some cases, it can result in the inability to love in a sexual way at all, where it's so damaging that, you know, you just become more and more closed off, and where you can't even do it anymore. I wanted to read a brief excerpt from a This American Life from earlier this year. And this is a fascinating episode. I don't know if you guys listen to this program. It's on NPR. And this is an interview between the host and a guy who was sharing about his relationship. This is their Valentine's Day episode, okay, February of 2012. He tells a story about this couple who they started dating on like the third day of college when they were 18 years old, and then they were a couple for the next 13 years, almost 14 years. And they said they were a great couple. They talked about everything. They were sexually involved from early on. When their friends had trouble, they came to this couple to talk to them and to get help. And, in every way, we were really good friends, and we were like a model couple and stuff. But he's like, we never talked about marriage. And we would always just kind of slough it off if people would ask us about it. But he said one day he got to be 31 years old, and he says, you know, I want to talk about this. Why don't we ever talk about getting married? How about we get married? And she was like, well, I'm not ready yet. And he's like, well, what's going to make you ready? And she's like, I think we need to sleep around with some other people first. Because they had both only ever slept with one another because they had started dating at such an early age. And so they basically came up with this idea where they were going to spend the next 30 days, well, a 38-day period starting shortly thereafter, where they were going to be free to sleep with as many people as they possibly could, and then they would get back together, and then they would get married, or not. And they gave the analogy of something the Amish do called a rumspringa, where when they turn 16, they leave the community, they sleep around, they do drugs, whatever, and then when they turn 18, they got to decide whether they want to rejoin the fold and be Amish. And so here's his story. He says, so we decided to have a rumspringa from our relationship. And the other crazy thing is that we decided that 30 days was enough. Because probably within 30 days, sleeping with other people, we'll get all that out of our system in 30 days. It's like it's some, you know, gas that's been building up that they need to release or something like that. But he said, it turns out it's really difficult to all of a sudden become single at 31 when you've never been single for your entire life. Because all of a sudden I'm single, and I essentially had the emotional tools of a 17-year-old boy, because that was the last time that he had dated. And he said, it really did feel like having experiences as I would imagine I would have had as a teenager, where sex was this very powerful thing and it kind of overwhelmed you. But he said, I remember that my impulse would be to say, I love you during sex. That would be my impulse because that's the only way I was used to having sex. And I remember the first time I did end up having sex, I started to say, I love you. And then I just kind of swallowed it and I made it seem like I was coughing. It was like he couldn't decouple these things, this act of being joined to another person. And he said that didn't happen just once in that 30-day period. And so the host says, comments, he says, Kurt said it was just a month of incredibly intense feelings. He'd feel this crazy elation, or he would feel him walking down the street weeping. And it talks about just sleeping with girl after girl and how the girlfriend was out there doing the same thing. He said, you know, I think about it like I had this toy poodle when I was growing up. And he says, you know, one day our cat knocked this 5-pound bag of sugar off the counter, and that poodle just ate the entire 5-pound bag. And then for the next 3 days, he was just puking and puking and puking. And he said, you know, I've always thought about my dog. And he's like, you know, I wonder what that moment must have been for him when he was eating that 5-pound bag of sugar and how amazing that must have felt. And he says, I kind of feel like that's what's happening to me, is there's that, but then it's just like I'm puking and puking and puking for days afterward. Well, they end up, 30 days comes to an end, and then they decide to go another 30 days, and they go another 30 days, and it's hard to tell, it's hard to keep the feelings separated. And he said that he was like, okay, I'm not going to get into a relationship. A relationship is 3 dates. And so after 2 dates, he would just not, you know, ever call these women back, and they'd curse him out, and they were so mad at him. And then they end up, you know, they got about 3 months in, and they got together, and they decided, you know what, we're going to break up. We're done. And Kurt says, I do have a theory now. I do have a theory about if I do get married in the future. What I think I would want to do is have an agreement that at the end of 7 years, we have to get remarried in order for the marriage to continue. You know, like a driver's license or something that expires. But at the end of 7 years, it ends, and we can agree to get remarried or not remarried. Why? Because I think you get to choose, and I think it would make the relationship stronger. Ira Glass says, I don't know what I think of that, because I think actually one of the things that's a comfort in marriage is that there isn't a door at 7 years. This guy's not a Christian. And so if something is messed up in the short term, there's a comfort of knowing, well, we made this commitment. And so we're just going to work it out. And even if tonight we're not getting along or there's something between us that doesn't feel right, you have the comfort of knowing we got time. We're going to figure this out. And that makes it so much easier because you do go through times when you hate each other's guts. You know what I mean? Yeah, of course you do. Yeah. And no escape clause, weirdly, is a bigger comfort to being married than I ever would have thought before I got married. Really? Yeah. You know, I'd never thought of it that way. And then the interview ends with this. He says, I like thinking about it that way. You just see so many examples of where people don't think that way. you can see that deep down, that's not what he really wanted. You can see somebody that's been hurt by using sex the wrong way. And somebody who has a theory about what sex should be and what marriage should be and what commitment should be. And like it says in the Proverbs, there is a way that seems right to man, but in the end it leads to death. And that's why God says, you must not commit adultery. You must not do sex anything other than the way that I've designed it. And if you go the wrong way on this, you do that at your own peril. And if you go the right way on this, you're going to be in for a good life. He also says you must not steal. Well, stealing, you know, that's one that's probably a little more agreed on than the previous commandment. But, you know, when it comes to stealing, taking something that's not yours, you know, apparently God affirms the ability to own things, to own personal property, and that we shouldn't take something that belongs to somebody else. We shouldn't take something that's not rightfully ours to take. But it's more than stopping stealing. Ephesians 4 puts it this way, he who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, work hard, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has need. And so remember, we saw with these commandments, it's not just enough to stop doing the thing that it forbids, but also what's implied is the other part too. That it's not stealing anymore, but becoming someone who's a giver. I mean, it's hard to think of something more selfish than the act of stealing. I see that, I want it, I'm taking it. But the opposite of that would be, I have something, and you need it, and I'm going to give it to you. And so, you know, it's stopping the stealing, but it's also becoming a hard worker. You know, if we're going to have stuff to give, then we're going to have to work hard so that we have something to give. And then once we have something to give, we need to give it to other people. Not just keeping my stuff for me, not just hoarding, but becoming someone who's a generous person. That's really the vision here, is becoming a hardworking, generous person who loves others in that way and not a selfish taker who steals things. There's a lot of ways to break this one other than just, you know, walking up and just, you know, breaking into someone's car and driving away. You know, there's employee theft. This is taking stuff from the place where you work. And actually, I read several different in several different places that employers lose more to this than they do to shoplifting. Is employees just stealing things right out of the store they work at. Clothing, food, whatever. There's borrowing money or stuff, you know, where you borrow money and you just never pay it back. Or the long-term borrowing of, you know, people's, you know, tools or my books. And then they don't bring them back and you got to track them down. And you must not steal, people. Various types of fraud, you know. There's insurance fraud. This is where, you know, you say something was stolen, but it really wasn't stolen. You just do that to get the money. Return fraud. Oh, yeah. That's where, you know, buying something and every 3 months, returning it for a new one. I heard about a guy the other day who would buy electronics, one just like the old one that he had, and then he would transfer the serial numbers over, and then he'd return the old one. So you get a new thing for free. Tax fraud, not paying your taxes. Academic fraud. This would include things like plagiarism, cheating, you know, where you're basically trying, you're stealing better grades than you should get from your academic institution. There's this one here. You know, God has given you certain gifts and abilities, and using those gifts, instead of using them for his honor and to serve him, you use them for yourself. Jesus tells a story where there's a parable where this master who represents God gave a bunch of money to all these different servants of his. And when he got back, one guy had not done anything with it. And he's like, you wicked, lazy servant. Give me that. I'm giving it to the guy that did something with it. And you get out of my sight. You know, and that one's a little harder to detect, but really it's taking something that God gave you and not using it the way that God intended you to use it. Really, any failure to work hard and give. You know, people that sit around refusing to work and just taking from other people, even taking from the government. Cases where you can work and you just prefer not to and you'll just take money from the government. I mean, you know, that's, what is that other than a violation of what he's talking about right here? So you must not steal, God says. you to be a generous giver, one who loves other people instead of a selfish taker. He says you must not testify falsely against your neighbor. No testifying falsely. Well, this really, I mean, the original context here would have been a courtroom setting, right? But this definitely could be extended to include all forms of dishonesty, lying. You know, back then it would have been pretty bad. You know, if you could get a couple of witnesses to make a false testimony against somebody, then you could get them convicted. And so there would have had to been some conspiring and lying to get this other person in trouble. But really, all forms of dishonesty would be included under this, all forms of lying. The reason for that is because God's people should have integrity. God's people should speak the truth. You know, lying is usually, it's inherently selfish. I'm bending a report of reality because, you know, I'm going to gain something from it. You know, if I tell the truth here, there would be a cost. So I'm just going to lie, and then I'm not going to have to suffer whatever cost I might have had to suffer. And so the vision here is of becoming people of integrity. People of integrity. One problem with lying is that it breaks down trust, which that's going to hurt our relationships and it's going to hurt our testimony about God. I mean, the Israelites, they were supposed to be a holy nation, a group of people that was going to be God's light to the rest of the world. They were going to tell the rest of the world what God is like. And yet, if they're liars, then what reason is there to believe their word about God? You know, and lying is going to break down trust, you know, and you can see why that's going to hurt your relationships as well. You know, if somebody can't trust you, then they really can't have much of a relationship with you. You know, they're always going to wonder, is this person really telling me the truth? Is this person exaggerating things here? Is this person, you know, it's just kind of a sneaky, slimy, almost like a used car salesman kind of feel is what you end up having here. When you're a liar, when you're not an honest person, a person of integrity, you always just kind of wonder, when is something else going to come out here that this person's been lying about? When am I going to find out what really happened? When am I going to find out what they really think and what they were really up to? There's a lot of different ways to break this commandment. I mean, you've got the direct lying about things. You know, I mean, if it wasn't for God, then, you know, what reason would there be not to lie? Why not spin things in a direction that benefits me? Misquoting or misrepresenting, though, is one. Or you're telling a story about what happened, and you misquote what the other person said. You kind of jazz it up a little bit to make it more shocking, more interesting, more funny, to make them look stupider. You misrepresent events so that you end up looking better in that situation. You know, you talk about how the person went off on you. What you fail to mention is how you were the one that started the whole thing. How, you know, you would have gone off on you under those same conditions. And so, you know, it's just some people, the way they tell stories, you can tell they just don't have much respect at all for the truth. And they're spinning things in a way that makes them look better. It's selfish. Hiding sin. This is a form of lying. I'm always shocked about, in any particular group of Christians, how many of them are actually lying at any given moment? How many of them are hiding sin? How many of them are engaged in nothing less than sheer hypocrisy? Because you did something, you said something, you've been doing something, and, you know, you've just decided it's going to be better here if I just cover this thing up. You know, I've wondered, is it 25% of Christians at any given moment, in any given crowd on average, that are hiding sin and lying? Going around suffering. Because like David says in Psalm 32, you know, when I kept silent about my sin, I wasted away because your hand was on me, God. And that's the thing that you feel when you're lying, when you're hiding your sin. You can actually feel God's hand upon you, and you feel exhausted just from trying to keep it in, just from trying to hide it. I knew a guy once that had been hiding this one particular sin for several years. And when he finally came out with it, he also admitted, you know, I feel like this was a major barrier in my relationships. Because every time I would get into a conversation where we'd start to be real vulnerable with each other, where we'd start to open up, I realized, you know, if they ask me the wrong question here, I'm not going to be able to control my facial expression. I'm not going to be able to keep this lie up. And so, I better pull back right now. Kept him at arm's length from everybody for several years. And the whole while, you know, he's got this internal agony. Things are getting worse, and he can't get the help that he needs. Failure to confront, that would be another form of dishonesty. instead of speaking the truth in love like God calls you to, you just kind of avoid people that have problems. You avoid messy, confrontational type situations. Man, I remember one time I was talking with this guy. I was talking with this brother who I was living with, and I was sharing with him some concerns I had about his life. And I feel like in that moment, I was really finally starting to break through to this guy, where he was starting to realize, maybe I really do have a problem here. And I was like, maybe you should talk to some other people and see what their thoughts are. Well, he goes and talks to this other roommate of ours, one who had been complaining to me just a couple days before about that issue that I brought up with that dude. He goes to that guy, and the guy's like, oh, no, I don't think you have a problem. Just completely changes his tune right to the guy's face. The guy's asking for feedback. And, you know, it was just a bold-faced lie. It was a lack of love. He just didn't want to deal with it. If you're going to tell the truth, that means you're going to have to deal with some things that maybe you wouldn't have to otherwise. But that's just part of the cost here. That's what God is calling you to. Exaggeration is another one here. You know, and this can really go both ways. It can be destructive in two different directions, you know. I'm not talking about, like, you know, not using figures of speech and things like that. But what I'm talking about here is, you know, on the one hand, you know, exaggerating to the negative. Or there's exaggerating to the positive. You know, exaggerating to the negative. What do I mean by that? Well, this is where this would kind of be a form of the misrepresentation above, where you exaggerate how bad you're being treated by this other person, where you exaggerate what this other person did to me, and you're trying to make them look worse in the situation than you. But there's also another kind of wrong exaggeration, and this is where you pretend like the Christian life is just really great and nothing is ever wrong, and you convey this to newer believers, that there's nothing wrong, and you know, it's just all easy and nice and comfortable. And then when trials hit in their life, because you haven't been real, you haven't actually shared with them also the hard parts. When trials hit in their life, then they're in danger of losing their faith, because they feel like there must be something messed up about me, that I'm still sinning, that I still have these problems, that I'm facing these trials, and they might be tempted to go another direction, to walk away from God. And so he says, thou shalt not lie. You must not testify falsely against your neighbor and under any circumstances. Finally, the 10th commandment is this. You must not covet your neighbor's house. You must not covet your neighbor's wife, male or female servant, ox or donkey, or anything else that belongs to your neighbor. So you must not covet your neighbor's house. And that's just a word for kind of like his household, anything he owns, that sort of thing. You know, this word covet here, this literally means to desire something, to crave something. And the commandment is not you must not covet, because he would be saying, that would be like saying you must not desire. Like desire is inherently evil or something like that. It's not necessarily wrong to desire. There are some worldviews that say that, you know, your main problem in your life is that you have desire at all. No, God actually created us to desire things, to desire the good things that he's made and to enjoy those in their proper context. You know, Isaiah 53 actually talks about desiring Jesus, and that's a good thing, desiring the Messiah. And yet, what he's talking about here is desiring something, craving something that you don't have a right to, something that is an improper object of desire. And you know, this is internal, but can quickly lead to external acts. You know, this is different than the previous commandments. You know, this is more like the first commandment. You know, the first commandment, God said, no other gods before me. That's a command that governs our thoughts and our heart. And the 10th commandment ends the same way. It's a commandment that governs our thoughts. It governs our heart. God says, do not desire something that you shouldn't desire. James says this. He says, temptation comes from our own desires, which entice us and drag us away. You know, this is the raging selfishness on the inside that we have, that we all have. And he says that's where these temptations come from. You know, in James's day, people were blaming God for causing them to be tempted. And James says, no, this is your fault. Your problem is you've got these selfish desires on the inside of you. And he says when those desires, when they go unchecked, it says they give birth to sinful actions. And when sin is allowed to grow, it gives birth to death. Yeah. And so these desires that we have within, That is really what this commandment is governing. In case you might say, well, I can keep the other commandments. I can keep those. God is like, let's just go ahead and tack this one on there as well. How about we just make a rule that you are never allowed to desire something you shouldn't desire? You know, that'll solve our sin problems, wouldn't it? If we just never desired something that we shouldn't want, if God's law went all the way down onto our hearts and we followed it voluntarily at that level, wouldn't that make this world a whole lot happier place? You bet it would. And that's the problem with us. You can read the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 7, wrestling with the law of God, and it's really this commandment right here, this 10th and final commandment. He says, when I read, you shall not covet. It just sent him down this internal wrestling where he's like, I know what to do. I know God's law. I know what God says is right and wrong, and yet there's something deep inside of me that doesn't do what I want to do. I want to do it, and yet I find myself doing the opposite thing. Eventually, he cries out, wretched man that I am, as he feels this tension between himself and between what he's doing, between God's perfect instructions for how to live the good life and the kind of life that he was living, the kind of things that he was thinking inside of his heart, tormenting him. I mean, you can see how these are tied in with the previous commandments. You must not covet your neighbor's wife. That's obviously going to lead to committing adultery, isn't it? This is the root of the adultery that springs up out of the ground. He says you must not covet your neighbor's stuff. Well, isn't that going to lead to stealing? You can see where lying would come in on this. You can see where murder might even come into play in certain situations. This raging selfishness within is going to come out in place after place after place. And God is showing his people that you must not even want to do the wrong thing. This is going to include jealousy, envy, any form of ingratitude. You know, really, contentment would be the opposite of this. We can learn how to live a life of contentment and joy, happy with what God has given us. You know, I mean, imagine you see, you know, your neighbor has some nice stuff, or your neighbor has a nice, really nice spouse. And neighbor means like anybody, you know, not just like your immediate neighbor. And, you know, you could look over there and you could be like, that's so cool that he has nice stuff and a nice spouse. I'm really happy for him. God, you know, God is the giver of all good things, and God has really blessed this guy, and praise God. You know what? God's really blessed me a lot too. And, you know, you could start thinking about those things. But instead we look over there and we're like, I want that. I want her. I want him. I want your life. I want something you have. And what I have is not good enough. That's the implication with coveting. What I have is not enough. I want the other thing. We're happy when the person fails. We're happy when maybe there's an opening for us. It's also going to include pretty much any kind of lust. You know, relational lust, desire for a boyfriend, girlfriend, romantic relationship, desire for, you know, I'm just not happy until I get this thing. Sexual lust of various kinds we talked about earlier. Feelings lust. This is where I just want to feel a certain way. And I'm not happy unless I'm feeling a certain way. And I'm demanding that God make me feel this way. Comfort lust, where I'll just do anything to be comfortable. Freedom, where if I could just get away from my parents, if I could get out of this living situation, if I could get out of this relationship, then I'd be happy. Materialistic lust, if I had their stuff, if I had, you know, their technology, if I had that new computer, if I had that data plan, you know, then I would be happy. If I had that television, if I had that car, if I had parents that would provide money for me so I didn't have to work so hard while I'm in school like this other person has. Glory lust, you're angry when other people get recognition and you don't. Appearance lust, you're jealous of how that other person looks. You're jealous of that other person's clothes. Abilities, you're jealous about what the other person can do, about their intelligence, about their personality. Even ministry, where you're just like, I'm jealous of the way God is using this person. And we're discontent. We haven't learned the secret of contentment. And ultimately, we're shaking our fist at God through this whole thing and saying, God, what you haven't given me, what you've given me is not enough. You are not enough, God. That's what you're saying. And so when we look at these commandments, just the final six that we studied the last 2 weeks, honoring your parents, no killing, no adultery, stealing, lying, coveting. And you know, you can imagine Israel with God, you know, pounding these commandments down out of the lightning, out of the thunder, out of the cloud. And then when you start to think about, as they must have been thinking as well, all the different things these involve, you know, honoring your parents, forgiving them, moving toward them in love, cultivating gratitude, working to repair the relationship, helping them out, viewing them with compassion, no hating, no bitterness, no slander, no gossip, no name-calling, failure to do everything possible to aid their life, no porno, emotional affairs, fantasizing, unrighteous divorce, homosexuality, cohabitation, other types of fornication, no employee theft, borrowing, various types of fraud, selfish use of your gifts, failure to work hard and to give, direct lying, misquoting, misrepresenting, hiding your sin, failing to confront, exaggeration, any lack of integrity, envy and gratitude, wanting anything you shouldn't want, and various kinds of lust. Pretty overwhelming list. That's not counting the first four, which are even harder. No other gods before me? Come on. And the people's response is pretty fascinating. He says, when the people heard the thunder and the loud blast of the ram's horn, and when they saw the flashes of lightning and the smoke billowing from the mountain, they stood at a distance, trembling with fear. And they said to Moses, you speak to us and we will listen, but don't let God speak directly to us or we will die. They realized how far short they fell of this perfect standard that God had just laid out for them. And Moses says, don't be afraid, for God is coming this way to test you so that your fear of him will keep you from sinning. You know, God knew when he said earlier in chapter 19, you just need to keep my covenant. And they're like, oh yeah, sounds good. God's like, these guys are never going to make it. And so he gave, and by fear, he means respect or reverence. So he's trying to show them who he is and what his demands are for them. And for them to admit they can't do it is part of what they needed to admit here. And he says, there's no way you'd be able to keep from sinning otherwise. But God, he saw there was a problem with you. And he needed to show you what that problem was. And he's trying to help you grow through that problem, like we talked about a couple weeks ago. And as the people stood in the distance, Moses approached the dark cloud where God was. So Moses goes back in after having this conversation with the people. And Yahweh said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel. You saw for yourselves that I spoke to you from heaven. And now he says, I want you to build for me an altar made of earth and offer your sacrifices to me. Build my altar wherever I cause my name to be remembered, and I will come to you and I will bless you. You see, this is the other major part of the law. What you should do is the first part, and then what to do when you don't do what you should do is the second part. And that's the sacrificial system. He says a sacrifice needs to happen here. And it's not just any altar. He says, I want an altar made of earth. He goes on to say, if you use stones, I only want uncut stones. I don't want you carving some, you know, graven image here. I just want you to find a big pile of rocks, and that's what you sacrifice on. You know, what that's symbolizing here is it's not your intricate skill that makes you acceptable to me. It's no work on your behalf that makes you acceptable. It's me. And it's my mercy given to you who's offering up this sacrifice where you realize I deserve to die. And but God, would you take this animal instead? And it's really the act of faith there is what forgave people. And so no carvings here, and that's to symbolize it's not by works. It's there's nothing special about us that can merit this. And he also says, do not approach my altar by going up steps. And so we wonder, is this also symbolic that by going up steps, this is doing some work for God? This is us being proud and ascending to a place where God is? And the answer is no, that's not the reason for that. The reason is this. If you do, someone might look up under your clothing and see your nakedness. That's what it says. But the point is, this is a significant interaction. And when Moses recounts this in Deuteronomy, he fills in the one important detail that he left out. He's referring back to this in Deuteronomy chapter 18. And God says, this is what you yourselves requested of Yahweh your God when you were assembled at Mount Sinai. This altar was kind of the short-term solution to this feeling that they felt, this feeling that we need a sacrifice. But God says, here's what you really requested. When you said, don't let us hear the voice of Yahweh our God anymore or see this blazing fire or we'll die. He says, I know what you are really asking for. And then God makes a prediction here. Yahweh said to me, what they have said is right. They will die. That's right. If you're feeling, I'm not good enough for this, and you're feeling a tremendous sense of guilt, that is actually how God wants you to feel in response to his law. At least that's part of how he wants you to feel. But the other part is related to this promise. He says, I will raise up a prophet like Moses from among their fellow Israelites. A prophet like Moses in the sense that he speaks on behalf of God. God speaks with this person face to face. He says, I will put my words in his mouth. He will tell the people everything I command him. And I will personally deal with anyone who will not listen to the messages the prophet proclaims on my behalf. He says, this is my man one day I will send. And you need to listen to him. And I'm going to deal personally with anybody that doesn't. Who was this guy? Well, we read in the Gospels that 1,500 years later, at the time of Christ, they were still searching for the prophet. They go up to John the Baptist. They're like, are you the prophet that Moses predicted? Well, in the book of Acts, Peter and Stephen, they both tell us what we already knew. That God sent the prophet, his son Jesus Christ. And that he was the one who would deal with this gap between what was declared from Mount Sinai about how we should be, how we should live, and how we really live. How far short we fall of God's righteous standard. Jesus became our sacrifice. The solution was a sacrifice, but an altar made of uncut stones wasn't good enough. What we really needed was the true Lamb of God, the one who takes away the sins of the world. He became our sacrifice. He is the one who pays our debt. And he is the one that makes us worthy to stand before God. So as we stand under God's law, no longer do we just stand and we feel the sense of guilt. But we look to Christ and we feel a tremendous sense of gratitude of what I deserved and what I got. Yeah, Lord, we're so thankful that you love us. We're thankful that you love us enough to tell us the truth, which is that we don't meet up to your standard. And that you want us to understand how perfect and how high you are, God. And yet I thank you, too, that you didn't leave us there in our hole, in that pit, Lord, but that you've done something about it. You've done something to bridge the gap, and you've done the ultimate unthinkable thing, which is to send your only son as a sacrifice, God, to pay the penalty that we owe for sin. Thank you, God, that now as we look at the law, that we can say with the Apostle Paul, we can cry out, who will save me from this body of death? And we can say, thanks be to God in Christ Jesus our Lord, because there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Thank you for that promise, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.